1 Samuel chapter 17, begin reading in the 40th verse. And he took his staff in his hand and chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook, and put them in a shepherd's bag which he had, even in a scrip, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, and ruddy, and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, Am I a dog, that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, Come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air, and to the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, Thou comest to me with a sword, and with a spear, and with a shield. But I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee. And I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And it came to pass, when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag, and took thence a stone, and slung it, and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistine saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and of Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until thou come to the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Shaarim, even unto Gath and unto Ekron. When I was a junior in high school, my literature teacher gave us the task of reading one of the literary classics by Homer called The Iliad. The Iliad is the story of the great battle between the Greeks and the men of Troy. And it concludes with a legendary duel between Achilles, who was the champion of the Greeks, and Hector, who was the champion of Troy, each fighting as a representative for his respective army. In the literary history of antiquity, reference is made to this particular military practice of single combat, or if you please, champion warfare. Champion warfare is a matter of two champions standing against each other to decide the outcome of the whole battle, instead of two opposing armies engaging in a battle in which both sides might very well incur substantial casualties. There would be great bloodshed. Each side would produce a champion to represent them in a winner-take-all duel. In the Iliad, of course, Achilles was the champion again, who represented the Greeks, and Hector represented the people of Troy as their champion. And of course, Achilles slew Hector. And if you may know that after that, the Greeks built the Trojan horse and went into the city of Troy, and they finished the job there. But there are other real-world examples of this principle of champion warfare. In the Middle Ages, it was a very common practice among the samurai for each side to produce a champion. And if their champion won, the whole army won. If their champion lost, the whole army lost. It was common among the Arabs. And it was common, again, in the Greco-Roman world of classical antiquity. Last week, we looked at Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 and following, in the section known as the Christian in Complete Armor. And the apostle says to the saints at Ephesus, "Be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." And we talked about the fact that the Christian life is a battle. It is, isn't it? It's a battle to keep your attitude right. It's a battle to keep your relationships functioning biblically. It's a battle to keep from sinking into discouragement and despair and despondency. It's a battle to face all of the setbacks and disappointments of life without losing heart. It's a battle to resist temptation. There's so many temptations to which we're subjected in this world, and it's a battle to be faithful to the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, military imagery is the dominant metaphor or image in the New Testament to describe the nature of Christian discipleship. What does it mean to be a Christian? Well, far and away, it means that we fight until we die, and then we can rest forever. You say, "I want to rest now." Well, there is a rest that remains for the people of God now in the gospel and in the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is our Sabbath rest. "Come unto me," he said in Matthew 11:28, "all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." There's a spiritual rest. But far and away, the bulk of our lives is described by this image of warfare. Every day, it's a fight to keep your thinking straight, to believe the truth instead of the lie, to follow God instead of the crowd. It's a battle, if you please, in a spiritual sense. The Christian life is a fight of faith. It's a spiritual battle. It's not a traditional political conflict between Republicans and Democrats, or between the rich and the poor, or between the haves and the have-nots. But this is a struggle, not for power or territory, but a philosophical conflict between truth and error, light and darkness, good and evil, righteousness and sin. Because we fight not against flesh and blood, as Ephesians 6 says, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places, therefore we need to don the Christian armor, don't we? We need to put on the whole armor of God, and not go into the battle of life unprepared. And that's one reason coming to the house of God on Sunday mornings is so important, because it helps you again to remind yourself of what it means to be a Christian in an ungodly world. It reminds you once more of the truth, ultimate reality. You're put back in touch with God. And that, my beloved, will help you and me in Monday through Saturday as we try to deal with difficult people and we face the disappointments and the pressures of life, to keep our thinking straight and not to lose focus, not to get in the flesh. We fight a threefold enemy. We talked about this last week: the world, the flesh, and the devil. The Christian's triple threat. And I want to say this morning that the goal before us in this good fight of faith is not to eliminate and defeat the enemy. The goal is not victory. The goal is to survive. You saw that in Ephesians 6, didn't you? Listen to this. "Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to defeat the devil." Is that what it says? No, withstand. "And having done all, to stand." Stand, therefore. Stand. That simply means don't abandon ship. Don't throw in the towel. Don't surrender to the enemy. You keep standing so that when the dust settles, you're going to be found faithful. The goal that you and I face is not to defeat the devil. Do you know why? Because we can't defeat the devil. He's stronger than us. He's more crafty than we are. This idea that the devil has a red suit with horns and a pitchfork and a long red tail, you know, a sort of a caricature, that's not biblical. The devil's a formidable foe. He's like a roaring lion. He's not a little kitty cat. He's a lion hungry for blood, and he's seeking whom he may devour. My beloved, whether we like it or not, this is the spiritual reality in which we live in this world. And that's why the goal facing us is not to beat him, but to simply stand by putting on the whole armor so that we can resist his wiles, raising the shield of faith. We're to find our strength, in other words, like David did, in the Lord and in the power of his might. Because he's the only one who can win the victory. He's our champion. And he's the only one who can win the victory and defeat the devil. And here's the good news of the gospel. The victory is already ours. The outcome of the war has already been decided. Here's the good news. You're on the winning side. Isn't it wonderful to know that though the side skirmishes in our lives continue, you say, this last Wednesday, Brother Mike, I had a real battle with my old fallen nature. Well, here's the good news. That's a side skirmish. But the war has already been won. Listen to Isaiah chapter 40, verse 1. Comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem and cry unto her. Here's the herald of the gospel crying to God's people, saying, I have good news. Extra, read all about it. Cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished. The war is over. When World War II was over and people went to the house of God and they worshiped and they prayed and they thanked God and they celebrated, the headlines, the war is over. What good news that is. It's even better news to know that your champion has already defeated your enemy, your biggest enemy. The devil is a defeated foe. You say, well, he still makes my... If he's defeated, then I'd hate to see him when he wasn't, because he sure makes my life miserable. Well, he's like a chicken with his head cut off. If you've ever dressed chickens, you know that once you decapitate that bird, the chicken continues to run around and scare the children, and sometimes the grown-ups, right? He's dead. He can't do any lasting damage except just make a mess of things. That's the way the devil is. He knows that his time is short. He's a defeated foe. Your champion has already won the victory. He won the victory because he put on the whole armor of God. Listen to Isaiah 59:17. Here is in prophecy the language of the incarnate Christ coming into the world to fight the great war against sin, Satan, death, hell, and the grave. But God saw that there was none to help, and he saw that there was no intercessor. Therefore, because no man could solve the problem, therefore his own arm. And when the Bible speaks of the arm of God, it is using, and here's a 50-cent word, anthropomorphic language. You look at the root of that word, anthropology, that's man. To morph is to change into, to like a man. God is using language that people can understand. It doesn't mean that God has body parts. God is a spirit, says John 4:24, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. It's not that God is limited to a certain physique and a certain stature. God is infinite. But when it speaks of his mouth, it's talking about his truth. The mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. It's speaking of his revelation. When it speaks of his arm, it's speaking of his power extended to help sinners. We used to sing a song when I was a boy growing up at Muleshoe Primitive Baptist Church in West Texas that said, when my Savior reached down for me. And the idea is that God reached a long arm down from the portals of glory to pick me up from the dunghill of iniquity. My beloved, that's exactly what the image in Isaiah 59 is talking about when he says, therefore, because no man could solve the problem, his own arm brought salvation. The arm of God is an extension of his power to rescue. He reached down to save, to rescue. Jesus Christ is the arm of God. Therefore, his own arm brought salvation unto him, and his righteousness, it sustained him. Watch this, for he put on righteousness as a breastplate. and was clad with the garments of vengeance as a cloak. He put on zeal for clothing. It says that he gird his sword upon his thigh. Psalm 45, 17, gird thy sword upon thy thigh, O most mighty, and ride prosperously because of the truth. The image here is that the Messiah put on the armor so that he could come and fight the war in your place and in mine. Now we're to put on the armor, not to fight the war, for that's already been fought, but to fight these little side skirmishes, because the enemy refuses to admit that he's a defeated foe. You know, that's why the devil is so foolish. Because he's beaten. The old serpent's head has been bruised by the woman's seed, as Genesis 3:15 says. Christ has destroyed the works of the devil. The enemy has already been defeated, but the devil will not call and concede defeat. But in the back of his mind, he knows that he has but a short time. So he's doing what damage he can to rob Christ of the glory to which he's due right now, but he's already positionally defeated and will one day be cast into the lake of fire. Don't you love verses like 1 John 3:8, for this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. What did Jesus do? He won the victory. Now, our goal is not victory. Let me just say it like this. We define victory not in terms of defeating the enemy, but in terms of faithfulness on the battlefield. That's how you and I define victory. Okay, the victory is already ours through Jesus Christ our Lord. With that elaborate, lengthy introduction, look at 1 Samuel 17, where we read this morning. This principle of champion warfare, in which one hero represents the nation and fights the enemy, and it's a winner-take-all affair, is illustrated nowhere more clearly than in the very familiar story of David and Goliath, recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And may I say something about this chapter? It's probably one of the most familiar stories in the Bible. I'm sure everybody here has heard the story of David and Goliath, probably multiple times. But may I say that I believe that many folks who look at this story approach it completely incorrectly. They look at it in moralistic terms. They approach it like this. David was a great hero because of his faith in God. You too can be a David. You can be a great hero. You can slay the giants in your life. I'm sure there's a sense in which all of that's true. But it really depicts God as someone that can be used to make our lives better right now. The primary purpose of the story in 1 Samuel 17 is not to give us a life principle. May I venture to say this morning that 1 Samuel 17 foreshadows the cross first and foremost. The primary purpose of 1 Samuel 17 is this idea of champion warfare. Look at verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle, and were gathered together at Shochah, which belongeth to Judah. Now, Shochah was about 12 miles southwest of Jerusalem. The Philistines were seafaring people who lived in the Gaza Strip. And they were some of the holdovers or the leftovers of the people that were the native inhabitants of the land of Canaan when the children of Israel came in. You remember God told them, when you come into the land, you are to exterminate all of the natives. And the children of Israel didn't do that. You say, why would God command such a thing? Because these people were gross pagans and idolaters. And the Lord knew that if Israel did not obey him, then they would be tempted to supplement the worship of Jehovah with idol worship, which eventually happened. So God's plan was that you are to exterminate all of the Canaanites and take over their land. You'll have houses that you didn't build because somebody else built it. Vineyards you didn't plant. God's going to thrust out the enemy. According to Deuteronomy 33:27, it says, the eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms, and he shall thrust out the enemy before thee, and shall say unto thee, destroy them. and you're going to come in and take their place. That was God's arrangement for the nation of Israel. Well, the Philistines, together with several other natives, were not completely annihilated. And therefore, they became the arch enemy and nemesis of the people of Israel. Year after year after year, the Philistines brought great conflict to the Jewish people. And here they are now gathered about 12 miles southwest of Jerusalem at Shokah, and they're camped on the hillside. There's a valley between them and the children of Israel who are camped on the hills on the other side. The valley is called the Valley of Elah. And it says that Saul and the men of Israel, verse 2, were gathered together and pitched by the Valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines. So the army of Israel, the army of the Philistines, and it's a standoff. It's a who's going to flinch first kind of affair. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, Israel on the mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. Listen to verse 4. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath. So he came from the capital city of the Philistines, and he was a giant. Now he was one of the sons of Anak. You remember when the children of Israel came in to the promised land that Caleb said to Joshua, give me this mountain. 80-year-old Caleb. He was a courageous old fella, and he drove the sons of Anak off the top of that mountain, and he took possession of it for his people. Well, the Anakims were giants. The sons of Anak were giants. And this particular giant is named Goliath, and it says he was 6 cubits and a span in height. Now that is about 3 meters tall, or about 9.5 feet tall. If you think of the comparison between Spike Lee and Shaquille O'Neal, you have a good idea, perhaps, of what most of us would look like up against one of these sons of Anak. Now, of course, Shaquille O'Neal isn't even 9.5 feet tall. He's a little over 7 feet tall. And that would have been considered short compared to Goliath. Now, he's a huge man. He's an imposing sight. He's an intimidating figure, and he shows up as the champion of the Philistine army. And it says he had a helmet of brass on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of his coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. Now, I don't know how much that would equate to in modern weights and measures, but I think it's sufficient to say that probably most of us could not even lift it. But yet, this is his armor. And he wears it every day. And it says that the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And one bearing a shield went before him, and he stood and cried against the armies of Israel. Now, if you were a soldier in Saul's army, and most of them were about our size, how tall are you? You say, I'm 5'10", I'm 5'6", I'm 6'2". That's about the max for most of us, right? We're between 5 feet and just a little over 6 feet tall. King Saul among the Jews was 6.5 feet tall, and he was head and shoulders above the rest. That is, if you looked at a crowd of people, he stuck out. He was head and shoulders above the rest. King Saul was the tallest and the most imposing figure among the armies of Israel, but he was dwarfed by Goliath's size. So when Goliath stood and cried against the armies of Israel, and he said unto them, why come ye out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine, and ye servants of Saul? Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. You wonder if he doesn't know that the odds are impossible, that, I mean, he's like he stacked the deck. Who can possibly compare to this giant? But remember one thing, a giant of Goliath's size wouldn't be nearly as nimble and move with the kind of dexterity that a smaller figure could move. Even Saul at 6.5 feet tall would be much more quick and able to move with greater fluidity. than Goliath could. You know, he could have great force, but probably wasn't real tactically precise. He certainly wasn't real quick. It says he would come out every day, twice a day, and I can just see him laying in his tent, you know, with his sandals off and, you know, drinking Coca-Colas and eating donuts. But he gets up twice a day to put on his armor and come out and say, "Is there anybody yet? If he's able to fight with me," he says, "and kill me, then we will be your servants, winner take all. And if I prevail against him, then ye shall be our servants and service." Now, what would such a battle as this accomplish? Again, it would save much bloodshed. But at the same time, the stakes were very high. If we win, then you're our slaves. If you win, we're your slaves, based on the representatives of each army. And the Philistine said, verse 10, "I defy the armies of Israel." Notice how haughty and insolent and defiant he is. "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now, Saul, if you read the previous chapters, had long since fallen out of fellowship with God. When he started out, he was a humble man. Saul didn't believe he was able to lead the nation, and he relied on God, and it says he hid himself among the stuff, among the baggage. Saul didn't try to project himself forward, but the people naturally thought he should be the leader. He was the most handsome, he was the tallest, he was the most muscular. Saul looked in every respect like the kind of king they wanted. The only problem is he wasn't from the kingly tribe. He was a Benjamite. And God said the kings are supposed to come from which tribe? The tribe of Judah. So the people's choice was not God's choice. But anyway, Saul was installed, and he started out okay, but it wasn't long before his position went to his head, and he began to take privileges. He began to mistake his position for a personal right. And he started to make an offering to God, remember? And Samuel came to him and he says, "It appertaineth not unto thee, Saul." 1 Samuel 15, he says, "Saul, it's not your business to make an offering to God. That's the role of the priesthood. They're the ones who make the offerings. You're the king. You're not a priest." And Saul says, "Well, I wanted to please the people." He's very focused on his popularity. Saul is constantly checking his poll numbers. He's constantly watching to see what people think about him. He's very concerned with peer pressure. He becomes a driven rather than a called man, driven by his own ambition instead of leading because he has a sense of his divine calling and his responsibility to God. And so Saul has long since fallen out of favor and fellowship with God, and that's why he's afraid of Goliath. Who would the people expect to accept the challenge against Goliath? Who would they have expected? Their leader, right? He's the tallest. He's the most formidable warrior that we have. He would be the champion of the nation of Israel. So when Goliath says, "Choose a man that we may fight together," Saul naturally should have stepped forward and said, "Okay, I'll do it." He would have been the John Wayne of the moment. But yet Saul is afraid. And because Saul is afraid, the people are afraid. Here's what you call trickle-down cowardice. When leadership fails, the people follow suit. The soldiers are frightened because the leader's frightened. He's lost sight of God, and all he can see is this big monster standing in front of him named Goliath. And the soldiers, therefore, none of them, they say, "Don't look at me. Choose a man that we may fight together." And somebody looks at Saul, and he said, "Just a second, I think I have a cell phone call. I have got to go take this call." You know, and somebody else says, "No, don't look at me. You know, I'm not foolish. I want to save my hide." Meanwhile, Jesse has sent David. Now, David is not yet 20 years of age. In the book of Numbers, we learned that the soldiers in the army of the children of Israel had to be at least 20 years old and upward. Remember when they numbered those that were able to go to war? They were those that were 20 years old and upward. David is not old enough yet to go to war. That means he's a teenager. David was probably 15, 16, maybe 17 years of age, a teenager. And his father calls him and says, I want you to go check on your brothers who are enlisted in the army. See how they're doing. Take them some cheese and some victuals. I want you to take them some parched corn and some loaves. Run to the camp to thy brethren. Carry 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000. And look how thy brethren fare, says verse 18, and take their pledge. Now, by the way, verse 16 says that Goliath's taunts occurred every morning and every evening for 40 days. That means 80 times. 40 times 2. Every morning and every evening for 40 days. The Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. That means 80 different occasions. They had had to hear this insolent, defiant taunt. Choose a man that we may fight together. Who among you is brave enough to be the champion of Israel? Jesse then sends David up to check on his brothers. And when David arrives and greets his brothers, suddenly Goliath comes out of his tent that morning and starts his speech. And the men began to shrink back and to run to hide. And David is standing there and he can't believe his eyes or his ears. And David is livid. He says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should dare to defy the armies of the living God? And when David's brother Eliab heard what David was saying, he went to him, verse 28 says, and he was very angry with David, and he said to him, why camest thou down thither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness or insolence of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. Here's the big brother saying to the kid brother, who's just a teenager, little boy blue, go blow your horn. The sheep's in the meadow and the cow's in the corn. With whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? Go home, David. This is men's work. And you're not yet old enough. I know what you want, David. You just want to be able to go home and brag to your buddies that I was there. I know the naughtiness of your heart, David. And listen to what David responds to his brother. What have I now done? Doesn't that sound familiar? Don't you see that dynamic play out between older siblings and younger siblings? What have I done now? He asked, is there not a cause? You see, David is looking at this whole situation in a different set of terms than everybody else around him. They're all seeing the giant. That's all they can see. We're in trouble. We've got a formidable enemy. We can't beat him, and we're in trouble. David looks beyond the giant, and he sees the whole situation in terms of the cause of God and truth. David, here's the first time in this whole narrative the name God comes up. David says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? First time that anybody's even thought about God. I'm sure when they heard the name God, they thought, what, I hadn't even interpreted this in spiritual terms. David's the first one to do that. He sees that this giant is threatening the glory of God and the people of God. Is there not a cause? May I say that the cause of Christ, the cause of God and truth, is the greatest cause that this world has ever seen. And pretty soon the news that David is talking big gets back to King Saul, and Saul says, call for him. And I'm sure Saul thought, finally, somebody has stepped forward. But as soon as David walks in Saul's tent door, Saul's heart falls, because he sees that David is just a stripling of a youth. He's just a shepherd boy. He's 15 or 16. His muscles are still forming. And Saul probably thinks, oh man, I shouldn't have even got my hopes up, because now they're dashed. And David's first words to Saul, verse 32, are, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Notice how David volunteers. Your worries are over, Saul. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go. I mean, for all intents and purposes, there is nothing in David's history, experience, physique, training that spoke the possibility of victory. And of course, the stakes were high, remember? Because if he lost, that means the whole nation lost. Champion warfare. Saul says, "But for thou art but a youth." And he's a man of war from his youth. David, you're just 15, 16. Since he was 14, Goliath's been fighting. He has you outsized, out-experienced. And David said to Saul, let me tell you a story. Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. Now, he's the shepherd. What would you do if you were a shepherd watching the sheep and a lion took one of the little lambs? Well, many people today would probably just sit back and say, well, one is not that big of a deal. I'm sure not going to get involved. But David cared for his sheep. He went after the lion and caught him by his beard and slew him with his bare hands. You say, he must have been really strong. No, David's strength came from God. God won that battle. The same with a bear. A bear took one of the little lambs, and when David pursued him, he smote him and slew the bear. And he said, thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God, the Lord that delivered me. Notice to whom he gives the credit. Who gets the glory for your victory over the lion and the bear, David? God does. David says, I couldn't have done it. It was a supernatural thing. It was physically impossible for me with my bare hands to kill a lion and a bear, but I did it because God gave me special supernatural strength. The Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion, out of the paw of the bear, he shall deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And apparently, for some reason, Saul, that convinces him. And I wonder what's in his mind, because still the stakes are high. But Saul says, okay, go, and the Lord be with thee. Saul was only too glad not to have the problem. He was just glad somebody else stepped up so he didn't have to do it. And Saul put his armor on David. And it says that when David started to go out with that armor, he stopped and he said, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. I've never worn these in my life. I don't know how to use them. I'm not a soldier. I'm a shepherd. David was not experienced. He said, I need to use what I know. I need to stick with what I know. So David had his pouch and he had his sling. And he went down to the brook and he found 5 smooth stones. And he put them in his shepherd's pouch, and he came out to Goliath. And that's when we pick up with the reading that we began with this morning. And Goliath comes out, and he sees David standing there, and Goliath is livid. He says, am I a dog that you come to me with a boy with staves or sticks? Now, you can just see a little boy sent out by his parents to drive a dog away with sticks, knocking the sticks together, saying, shoo, get out of here. And Goliath says, do you think I'm a dog? Now, if he was mad before, he's really mad now. He says, I'm insulted that you would meet my challenge with such a kid as David. And David says, thou comest to me with a spear, with a sword, and with a shield. But I come to thee. Notice he doesn't say, I come to thee with a slingshot. He doesn't say that. I come to thee in the name. You come with something, I come in the name of someone. Here's the key. The key is not what you carry with you, it's who you represent. You come with a sword, you come with your weapons, I come in the name of the Lord of hosts. That's Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of armies. And in the name of the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into my hand. And I will smite thee and take thy head from thee. And I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines to the fowls of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's. It's all about him. And it depends for its outcome on his blessing. and he will give you into our hands. And when the Philistine heard that, he said, okay, I've heard enough. And he started to move toward David, and David started to move toward the Philistine, and with dexterity he reached his hand into his shepherd's pouch, drew forth a stone, put it in his sling, whirled that thing around, and with the accuracy of a lead ball coming out of the end of a muzzle loader, he hit the Philistine right in the forehead. And the stone sunk into his forehead, which means it probably cracked his skull, did great brain damage. And the giant of Gath fell to the ground. The theological word is dead as a hammer. And David ran up to him. To notice, it's very careful to say that there was no sword in the hand of David. It says that several times. No sword, no sword, because the battle that he fought was fought not with carnal weapons, but with spiritual weapons. The Lord was fighting for David. And he took the sword out of the giant's own sheath. And I'm sure it was a heavy sword. And this young teenager lifted it up and came down and whacked the head of Goliath from his body, held the head up, and as soon as he held the head up, the Philistines, instead of bowing, saying, okay then, we're your servants, you win, here we are, we're your slaves, they turned and ran. So the children of Israel came out from hiding and chased them. I used to have a dog that would hide every time somebody came up to the house, under the house, and whenever they would leave, he would come out running and barking, you know, like he was a big dog, you know. That's what the children of Israel are like. They're like a scared puppy hiding, and as soon as they see that Goliath's dead, they say, okay, we can handle this, and they chase the Philistines. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him, but there was no sword in the hand of David. The battle is the Lord's. My beloved, do you see foreshadowing of the cross in this story? You see any parallels between David and Christ? God's people face a formidable, intimidating foe just like the children of Israel faced on that occasion. Our foe is just as intimidating. No one was able or capable of defeating Goliath, and so we're not capable of defeating sin. Yet David was dispatched by his father to go care for his brethren, and Jesus Christ was dispatched by his Father from heaven to come down into the battle to care for his brethren. David understands that the glory of God is at stake, and Jesus Christ understood that the glory of God was at stake, and he volunteers for the task. David was distrusted by his own brethren and by Saul. In their eyes, he simply did not qualify for the job. So Jesus Christ came into his own, and his own received him not. Neither did his brethren believe him. David represented the entire nation, and single-handedly he defeated the enemy. So Jesus Christ, our champion, represented all of the elect people of God, and as a result of our champion's conquest, all the covenant people of God participate in the victory. Champion warfare. David's fame then spread throughout the kingdom. So the fame of Jesus Christ has spread abroad throughout this world. Victory is already ours. Therefore, the task before us is not to defeat the enemy, but it's to stand, to survive, because the enemy is already defeated. The battle of faith that we're involved in today has already been settled forever. Thanks be to God, which giveth us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. You might ask this morning, Brother Mike, how may we stand in this good fight of faith? How may we survive? We can't defeat the enemy. He's already been defeated by our champion. How may we stand, though? By finding our strength in our champion, just like David found his strength in the Lord. David wrote some of the Psalms, probably reflecting on this episode. For instance, Psalm 3, verse 3. Be thou, O Lord, a shield for me, my glory and the lifter up of my head. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. No doubt he's drawing from the lesson he learned when he fought Goliath. Psalm 18, Verse 29, for by thee I have run through a troop, and by my God I've leaped over a wall. It is God that girdeth me with strength, says verse 32, and maketh my way perfect. Verse 34, he teacheth my hands to war, so that a bow of steel is broken by mine arms. Over and again, David draws on this imagery. He found his strength in his champion. Be strong in the Lord. Let me close with the words of Martin Luther's hymn. Did we in our own strength confide, in our good fight of faith, our striving would be losing. That's so true. If you fight the battle on your own and in your own strength, you're not going to win. We're not the right man on our side. That's what we've been talking about this morning. The man of God's own choosing. Dost ask who that may be? Christ Jesus, it is he. Lord Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts, is his name. From age to age the same, and he must win the battle. May we remember in our daily battles against the enemy, the war has already been won by our champion, and through him, you and I are more than conquerors, through him that loved us. We're on the winning side, and in his strength, we too can stand against the wiles of the devil.